Well, welcome back. We are back at the CBA banquet, and I am Trevin Stolzfus, along with Jake.
Kunkin? I got yours.
Kunkin?
You got it.
I keep, you know what I need to think of is Dunkin' Donuts.
That's it.
Because that's exactly how you say it is, Kunkin.
Yep.
I'm learning.
We're getting there.
This is our fourth, fifth?
Yeah,
anyway, we're getting up there in podcasts, so we're getting to know each other. Steve, introduce yourself. Let me lay some history. Steve, you and I have known each other for a while.
Yep.
We met through, was it Frank?
Yeah, we were at the Denver ISC, what is it called up there?
The Sportsman Show.
There you go, yeah. Sportsman's Expo up there. So you and I were up there chatting and got to know each other up there. And we both shoot Hoyts, and which actually now my fiance, she's a big Hoyt shooter, you know.
Yeah, and you guys, the reason they're coming on is they're awesome, number one.
Nice.
But number two, they have a story to tell on antelope that is amazing. And I'm begging Steve to write an article for the magazine, because it would be a cool story to supplement this podcast. So anyway, introduce you guys. Tell us about yourself, how you got into bow hunting, and then we'll jump right into this antelope adventure you guys had this last year.
Okay, well, I'm from Trinidad, Colorado, and I've been actually a hunting guide my whole life, but I've been an avid bow hunter for 30 plus years.
Oh, wow.
Since I was 12 years old, I was shooting a bow, you know, so my dad was a bow hunter, just was instilled in me, you know. So anyhow, been shooting with Hoyt for a few years now, and my fiance, now she's shooting with Hoyt, and rewind to last year, she was going on her first pronghorn hunt, and we set up some ground blinds in the summer, did some scouting, and we were seeing some great bucks. I mean, we had some 80-inch bucks cruising around our water holes.
Now, let me pause you for a second. So you were born and raised in that area.
Yep.
How about you?
Same. Born and raised.
So
we found the native Coloradans. We've been talking about you guys on podcast for a while.
Yeah, because everybody, I'm not native. I'm New Mexican, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's from New York. And, you know, Henry's a transplant, too. So we say there's only six real natives in Colorado. The rest are transplants.
You got two right here. Yeah. Yep. The chances.
Thanks for letting us stay in your state.
And so your background. Do you have hunting in your background?
Not really. My dad hunted, but we weren't really a big part of his hunts. He kind of did it to get away. There's eight children in my family, so he would do it to kind of get away from everyone and have some time to himself. So we weren't usually included in that, but I was exposed to it a lot growing up.
You ate wild game,
yes,
I assume.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, my mom prepared everything he harvested, so I was, you know, introduced to that. I worked on a guest ranch and happened to, where they have hunting, and happened to meet this hunting guide here. And
that was Steve.
Yeah. That was Steve.
What'd you think of her the first time you saw her?
I thought she was pretty.
Ooh la la.
Oh, yeah.
And so after we had been dating a little bit, and obviously I knew he was into hunting, and I love everything outdoors. If I can go be outdoors, I'm going to be outdoors. And
awesome.
So he started to kind of, you know, take me along on his hunts, and I just was so intrigued by the whole thing. Like, there's so much more to it than I could have ever thought, especially bow hunting.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big deal. So he took me out on a few hunts and just fell in love with it, and it's our favorite thing now.
It's an awesome thing to develop a relationship over.
Yeah.
There's so much to learn and grow and teach and share. I mean,
yeah.
it's
definitely teacher-student scenario, but I'm getting better.
Well, the cool thing is, 2 years ago when she first picked up her bow, her and I went out to Kansas, and she had a couple white-tailed doe tags, and unfortunately, she made a good shot on a white-tailed doe and didn't get a pass-through, and we couldn't find it. Long story short, she just stayed after it. She got hungry for bow hunting.
Yeah.
So that following spring, she shot her first gobbler in Kansas, and then she killed a gobbler with her bow in Colorado. Then she was able to harvest that 80-inch antelope this past season. So,
man, what a trajectory.
Yeah,
yep.
So that's
awesome.
Been the highlight so far is the antelope buck for sure. But
yep, yeah, she actually did good too. She killed her first bull this year too. So
man,
yep, my first bull elk this
year. You're about four species ahead of me.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and if you guys want to talk about the action packed day, we can start whenever you're ready.
Oh yeah, I'm excited. So you're scouting. When's that season open? Is that August 15th?
August 15th. Yep. Okay. So, anyhow, her and I put blinds up like a month before season starts, and we usually we put barbed wire fence around, keep the cows from knocking them down and whatnot. Set trail cameras up. And her and I have been keeping tabs, and we saw a whopper, and obviously is the one she ended up getting. But so we finally get up into that blind that morning. It's slow. Cows come in. They finally leave, and I'm just glassing, and I spot that guy coming. And my heart's racing more than hers, and she has the bow. And he's coming, and we're filming. He actually circles behind us, and I'm like, dang, I hope he didn't wind us or see us or something. All of a sudden, he circles around us, and he's coming straight to the water tank. And I told him, I said, honey, get ready. And my heart's pounding, and I look over. She's at full draw. That buck goes down to take a drink, and whack, she smokes him, man. And he takes off running. He's running. I'm looking out the back of the blind window, and I just watch him tip over, and I was so ecstatic. She was screaming. It was the coolest day ever in the woods, you know?
Wow.
So we go up there, and he's growing as we're walking up there. I knew he was big, but...
You saw this. This is one of the bucks that you'd seen scouting, though.
Yep.
So you were... Did you know it was him, or were you pretty sure it was a good buck? Or I mean...
I thought it was him, but okay. I didn't realize he had cutters like he did in mass. And you know, like when a pronghorn's old, he has nice ivory white tips.
Right.
Just a good old mature buck, big black cheek patches. Walk up to him, I grab him, I just feel that mass, and I know he's in like in the 80s, you know, like or up high 70s. And man, his cutters were like 5 inches on her buck, and it was just amazing. So you tell him how you felt that day, honey.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
Well, you know, when you're hunting and you imagine all these different scenarios of how your buck's going to come in. What if he comes in this direction? How am I you know, sitting the right way? Can I pivot? Can I do this? Can I do that? And as he was coming in, I thought he's going to come straight at us. What am I going to do? I wasn't really prepared for that. When he went behind us and then came around, he literally came. He couldn't have lined up more perfectly for me in the most perfect spot that I could take a good shot at. So,
how far was the shot?
20 yards.
Perfect.
So I had range. I know, perfect was right. And I had range. That's what I practiced at the whole time because I knew that the tank was 20 yards from where we had set up.
Yeah.
And so I had just been doing 20-yard shots. And so he just lined up perfect, and I just took a breath and...
Well, I got to throw something out here because... Just in the way you told that and prefaced that story tells me that there's something different about you, because not a lot of new bow hunters would be thinking about angles, would be thinking about positioning of their, how they're, you know, if you're left-handed or if you're right, where do my knees need to go? So you're like me. So I tend to like to be a little bit at an angle this way of my shot. Mm-hmm. So, but a newbie will sit square on. And there, well, what if there's an animal there? Well, if you're left-handed and there's an animal there, that's an incredible move I have to make. And for those listeners that can't see what I'm doing, I'm pointing to my left. And if I'm facing forward, I have to turn my body almost 180 degrees to get that angle. Mm-hmm. So you're already thinking about this.
Has your shot?
That tells me that you... are already kind of a little bit more advanced, at least in the preparation. So,
had you shot out of a blind before that day?
Yes, that's both huge. Of my turkeys I had shot, and so I'd practice sitting from, you know, shooting from sitting.
And also like going from light to dark,
light,
or dark to
absolutely.
Light.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting. That's big.
Yeah.
And so was this the first day you guys had sat the
very
water
first
hole?
Morning? Oh.
Very first morning.
Opening day.
Now, did you have a tag in your pocket too?
Yep.
So you didn't even bring your bow.
I didn't have my bow.
You're just cameraman.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Just filmed her, and after we took our field shots, I caped her buck out there. We put him on ice, and I don't know, it was like what, 1:32.
Right.
She's like, honey, it's early. Let's go try to get you one.
Now, when you walked up to it, you realized it was the same buck.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
You realized, and you get your hands around. What's going through your mind when you see how excited he is?
Yeah, it just brings it up a whole new level. His excitement just brought me up a whole, you know, I was proud of myself. I was relieved that I'd made a good shot. I was glad to see he went down so quickly. All the stuff goes through your mind so quick. But his excitement for me was just just brought it to the next level. I'm not familiar with cutters and different sizes, so I just knew it was an amazing looking animal, and I had, you know, harvested just the way I wanted it to, so that was good for me. I think he thought that my buck may be bigger than his could be, and so I think he was a little like, oh, she got this, she got a trophy.
Is that true, Steve?
It's true, yeah, yes, he can't deny
it. I actually told her, I said, more than likely I'm not going to kill one as big as you this year, because I've killed some bucks that are in the 80s, like 83 I think was the second biggest one I've shot, and but I've killed over 10 nice bucks with the bow, and when I walked up to hers, I said, this is something special. I said, you killed the buck guys hunt years for, you know.
Lifetime.
Yeah, lifetime, actually. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a kind of little competition sometimes, I think. We actually set up two separate blinds. And so I had picked one blind and he had picked the other. And I think what was going through his head was, dang, I should have got this blind.
Yeah. like I was telling you, after all that amazing morning, we didn't think it could get any better.
No way.
And Jess was saying, Steve, we might as well go try to push your luck and see what happens. And so we went back to my shop. We put everything in the coolers, you know, got her cape all put away. And so I grabbed my Hoyt, shoot it a little bit, and I'm dialed in. It's probably maybe 2 o'clock. We get out there. We're sitting in the blind. We're glassing, nothing. And then I look to my right. I see a doe, and she's coming right into the tank. I'm like, all right.
Same tank, or have you moved?
This is a different water hole.
You moved over to the one you picked.
Yeah, the one I picked. Okay. The one I thought was going to suck, actually. Yeah. So this doe is coming, and we're in that Primo surround view.
Oh, the one that you can see out?
Yep, so you can see all around you.
Yeah, 360 view.
And cool. I forgot to bring the blackout part for the back. And she comes in and she picks us up. I mean, boom. She sees something shining. Maybe the camera, I don't know. But she still comes in for a drink. It's hot. She's thirsty. She comes in, but she keeps looking to behind our blind. I'm like, what the heck is she looking at, you know? And I look back, I don't see anything. So I'm just trying to stay still. She takes a drink. She's real nervous. And she looks back behind me again. And then I hear like this.
Yeah.
And I look to my left. I said, oh, heck. I said, there's a buck coming, honey. So here he comes. And I knew he was a big one, but I didn't realize how big. I try not to look how big they are. Just try to focus on getting a good ethical shot, you know. So anyhow, he's coming off to my left, and he's heading straight to that water hole. That doe looks at me, grab my bow and lift it up, and she bails. And so he comes around, and he's facing me at, I think he was at 34, 35 yards, and I know he knows something's up. Like, they know, like, he saw the doe run off. He knows we're in there. She's like, honey, how far is he? And before she could even finish talking, I sent that Easton flying, hit, pinwheeled him right in the chest, dude. And
frontal shot.
Wow. But I shoot my bow every day, and I don't recommend people doing it.
Yeah.
But I felt 100% confident in that shot, and I shot him right perfect in the chest. He took off running. We're peeking out the side watching. He runs maybe 50, 60 yards and rolls over, done.
Man.
So I said, oh.
So he had the second burst of, he's down. We got it.
I'm like, oh my God, we killed two in one day. And like, to believe it or not, I didn't even know how big he was. I didn't even look at him.
Yeah.
And I checked cameras there. I mean, I saw some decent ones, but I didn't see this one. Mm-mm. And
we had no idea.
So we're walking up to him, and I said, holy smokes. I said, this buck is gigantic. And I'm sorry, honey, I beat you today. I said, he's bigger than yours, and yours is a whopper. And so I pick him up, and the second biggest one I shot was 83 inches, and I said, he's bigger than that one.
Wow.
So I lift him up. He has 7-inch cutters on him, and I know he's over 15 inches in length, and he's just massive, old buck, worn out teeth, and I was just ecstatic. I was like, couldn't believe it happened, but
insane.
At the end of the day, though, I beat her, so I'm happy.
The healthy competition.
Yeah, but
that's amazing, man. Is antelope your favorite hunt or your primary species you go after?
You know, we hunt everything you could think of.
Whatever season is our favorite.
Whatever is available.
So right? I'm for the viewers, I'm showing.
Oh my God! It's as long as its neck.
I know. I'm showing Jake a picture.
We'll post this if we're allowed. Yeah. If you can.
And then that's not. This is hers.
Oh my God, it's like palmed out. It's just stud. They're such cool animals. Yeah. So being from New York, we have whitetail, we have turkeys, but that's about it. There's some bear upstate, moose in, you know, Vermont. Mm-hmm. But I drove from New York to Denver in August of 2019, and it took like 2 weeks. I was just kind of moseying my way out here, and I went the northern route and dropped through the Badlands. And as I was leaving the Badlands, I just stopped for a second, and this antelope walks over the hill, and it's the first antelope I've ever seen in my whole life. And it's just this majestic creature. You're like, am I on the safari? Like, what is this thing? And I've been showing people pictures of it, and they're like, that's a giant antelope. And I was like, of course, the first one I've ever seen is like the biggest one I'll ever see.
They're beautiful animals. They're gorgeous. Really beautiful.
And I hear they're great to eat, too.
They're delicious. Yeah.
They are. There's a lot of people that say they're not, and I have to disagree. I think a lot of people shoot them with a rifle, throw them in the back of the truck, and then they drive around.
You're exactly
hunting
right.
More, or they're showing them around. And
it's summer. It's 90 right? degrees
and
out
there's
there.
And there's something yeah. about the oils and the tannins in their hide that yep. if you don't get the hide off quickly, it leaches into the meat, and mm-hmm. so it can give it a really negative flavor palate, if you will.
Right. Yeah.
But if you get the hide off, yep. it's some of the best eating, in my opinion.
So yeah, so when we head out, we load up our Yeti cooler full ice. We have a big one, mm-hmm. and we cool.
We're that confident. We bring ice with us. We're like,
but we
live like champs,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So we skin them right there in the field, right. Quarter them up, cape them, put them on ice. We take care of our meat. Obviously, we love bow hunting, but we love to eat wild game too.
That's
you
it.
Know.
Right. I'm the same way, and I actually started with fishing before I got into land hunting, if you will, and meat care is everything. I made one mistake one time where I had some striped bass fillets, and they got some water in them, and I drove 3 hours home, and I got home, and the whole thing was ruined. And I was just entire hunt, all that money, all that effort, and the whole purpose is to get the meat.
Yep.
I have a little trick for people with ice. My neighbor taught me this. Take a food saver, vac seal water. Now, don't get the water into the machine, but basically seal these bags, freeze these bags, and if it melts on you over the course of a week, go throw it back in your freezer, and then you just got these blocks of ice that are reusable.
That's a good idea.
That's an awesome very good idea.
Yeah. Well, you know, another thing I've done, too, this is not just for antelope hunting, but a few years ago, I shot this big bull for archery season down in the area I'm from. And this area, you can't go in there till after 10 o'clock a.m. to retrieve your animals. So I killed this bull 3 miles deep in off this well pad. And so I knew it was going to be hot that next day. So what I did is I caped him, quartered him, skinned him out. And I didn't have time to like really skin the quarters or anything. So I just got them all laid out on the grass. Then I got my bone saw out and actually cut all the oak brush, and I made a pile of oak brush on top of him and gave him enough shade to actually get me by to get him out.
Smart.
And I saved the meat by just having a bone saw with me, you right. know. So, right.
I think another good thing is gallon jugs of milk.
Yeah,
freezing those, and that can give you some of that more solid. But you know, you get a decent cooler like a Yeti,
yep.
and you know, you put. You condition it, and I always condition it with some gallon jugs of frozen water, and then when I head out, I take those, put those back in the freezer, and then I have some others kind of that I rotate out. But it works great because then you can get them cooled off the quickest.
Yeah.
Because meat care is everything. You know, you always hear, well, my uncle used to kill deer, and it was horrible. Well, then you start talking to them about how they prepared it. They overcooked it, or they didn't prepare it right, and so these bad experiences with wild game always come back to field care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I found out about a guy named Hank Shaw. He's like a wild game chef. He's got a few cookbooks. I think one's called Buck Moose. And
that's funny,
clever.
And ever since I got on that, I have not had a bad piece of game. And it just convinced me it's about preparation, but it's just also about how you cook your meat. Yeah. It's a lean meat. It's a different way to cook it.
And there's something special about eating your own harvest, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Last weekend, Jess and I went out turkey hunting. She smoked this beautiful gobbler in the most pristine country. We got some awesome pictures, but when we fried him up, it was so amazing. Like, we have a little recipe we use. Like, we'll put Frank's red hot sauce in a bowl, mm-hmm. slice up the turkey breasts, soak them in there, and like fry them, and it's like Popeye's chicken. Ooh. It's just amazing. Mm-hmm.
It's delicious.
And we're like, you know what? Hunting's awesome, but this is your true reward is getting that fresh meat like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. I've actually yet to harvest a turkey. I do have a spring tag. I'm curious, if you do kill a bird, do you gut it right away, or what's the process for...
You know, it depends. Like, if it's hot in there in the sun, like, if we have two tags... Like, sometimes I'll do that, but if it's not too hot, I'll just take them straight to the truck and throw them in the cooler, and they're fine, you know? But usually for a turkey to spoil, they have to sit out all day long,
you know? Right, but, yeah. I've even just reached up there, gutted them out, and...
Throw a water bottle
or something. A couple of frozen water bottles in there and stuff like that, so...
Yeah.
Jessica, I want to ask you... as somebody who got into bow hunting a little bit later, how old were you when you met this Yahoo?
You can't ask that on the podcast.
You were 18?
Right, okay. Correct.
Still is 18.
So, but talk us through the journey, not just the journey of a bow hunter, but as a female, because now you're dealing with, what's your draw length, 26?
26 and a half.
Okay.
So shorter draw length. Actually, I shouldn't say it because mine's only 27. But like my daughter's is 25, right? So my wife's is 25 and a half. Shorter draw length. My wife and daughter are pretty strong, but I mean, you know, they're pulling 45, 50 pounds, right?
Yeah.
And what was that journey like getting to that place of confidence where you could at 20 yards, you were confident, you took the shot, you know you're not so nervous about wounding this animal, not finding it, you've killed a turkey, you know, all these different things, an elk. What was that journey like?
Well, the first time I picked up a bow, well, I'll scoot back a little bit. Watching him practice his bow, I was just intrigued with the whole thing. I thought that just the whole process, just his mindset, how he, you know, he'd go out there and he could just tell it was just so intense. He had spent a lot of time doing it and he loved it, and you could just see it all in him when he was practicing his bow, and I thought that's just really cool. And I never thought I could shoot a bow. That didn't even enter my mind for a long time. And he just brought it up one day and he said, hey, let's go get you a bow. And I was like, that would be awesome. That'd be so cool. Like, I want to learn new things. I'm always up to learn new things. And I thought that would be something cool we could do together, which it is. We went up to the bow shop, and you know, when we started setting up my bow, I was like, I don't know, you know, this is intense. Like, I don't know if I'm strong enough to do this. Like, you know, just pulling it back for the first time, just feeling the power that little instrument, or not little, but the instrument had. I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I can do this. Like, so I just decided, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be really good at it, and I'm just going to practice all the time. And I loved it so much. It wasn't hard for me at all to, you know, take a few minutes out of my day and, you know, shoot my bow a couple of times until I felt confident.
Isn't it amazing how your body, the muscles you use with bow hunting are so different than anything else, but how quickly those muscles strengthen?
Yes.
And you know, you start at 30 or 25, like my daughter started at 25 pounds. It was a month and a half of her practicing, and she was pulling 45 pounds.
That's awesome.
Just that little time, because she conditioned those muscles.
Exactly.
And it helps to have someone like Steve, who is an experienced, confident bow hunter, has good technique,
right,
that he can say, oh, okay, do this, so that you can get that. The key in bow hunting is doing the same thing every time.
Right.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And once you get in there, it's like a golf swing. You know, you got to do it the same every time, so that your end result can be repetitive. And then you can make adjustments, you know.
And then for different types of hunting, you know, you're practicing different. So from a tree stand, you're shooting your bow a different way than you are from a, you know, sitting down shooting a turkey or something like that. So there's always, you know, something new to learn.
But now she's hooked. Now it's double expenses for me. So this, you know, it's funny. She said, guess what, honey? I said, what? She goes, I already put my vacation. I said, for what? She goes, I'm hunting the whitetail rut next year. She goes, because you got to sit in that tree stand during the peak rut, and it wasn't fair. So
that was torture. I was at work, and he was hunting the rut, and I got to hunt the post rut, but it's just not the same.
It's here in Colorado.
Here in Colorado.
So you're talking like mid-November?
Mm-hmm,
yeah. And you're hunting the river bottoms, so you're hunting rut and whitetail. There's something about that time of year. I go to Kansas and hunt whitetail, and a little bit in Colorado, but not as much for whitetail, because, you know, just where I live, there are some whitetail, but it's mainly private property I don't have access to.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how good a state Colorado is becoming for whitetail.
Well, I was telling you earlier, I shot a mid-150s buck in southern Colorado last year, and he was a beauty, you know? Yeah. I've always been a mule deer hunter growing up, but as the years are going on, these whitetails are moving further and further into Colorado. Mm-hmm. We're getting them up in the mountains, and I mean, we own a like 4-acre piece of river bottom, and we have tons of whitetail on our place. And matter of fact, she almost killed a 160 that we were seeing on the camera. She shot.
I was wondering if you're going to bring that up.
She shot right over him, but she didn't have time to range him.
Right.
He's moving, chasing does, but that's an experience that, like, I'm new to too. Like, when I switched gears from hunting mule deer to whitetails, I was missing those things. Were ducking me.
Right.
I wasn't aiming at them right. Like, it's a whole new ball game than being on your feet, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Anchoring on one, you know. But just like bow hunting, like, you're gonna make mistakes and you learn from them, you know.
And for me, I was 33 years old, grown up in New Mexico. I was 33 years old in Colorado before I ever climbed up a tree stand. I'd never been in a tree stand, period. We'd always spot and stalked or called elk or whatever, because New Mexico has coos deer, but you don't hunt them out of a tree stand. You still spot and stalk them, right? So I had no experience hunting whitetail, and I went with a buddy of mine to his place in Nebraska, and I climbed up a tree stand and shot my first whitetail. Since then, I've been hooked, and I'm hooked because I love bow hunting, but I'm also hooked because the chess match that is whitetail. It's very different than mule deer.
Yep.
You know, in a situation where you're hunting mule deer or antelope for that matter, if you're in a pasture and there's not antelope on these water holes, you relocate to the next one. Or if you're on a ridge and you're not seeing mule deer in the high country, well, you go find another ridge and you glass it up until you find them. Well, whitetail, you know they're there. You know they're within probably 200 yards of you, but they have to walk by that tree stand.
Yep.
And so, wind. How does wind affect you? It's different than in the mountains, because wind changes and you have thermals. Well, in the whitetails, usually you're down in these bottoms, and so you're hunting predominant winds mainly. So how do you approach this? I mean, there's all these factors that I found out, and it became like a chess match of moving. Okay, where am I going to put that stand? I think I'm going to move that stand over to this pinch point now. You know, all these different things. So I can see what you're saying, though, too. He's in the tree stand hunting during the rut, and he's probably texting you what he's seen.
Oh my gosh.
And you're
yes.
like, and I'm stuck here at work.
So I was trying to hunt before work.
Okay.
Still. So I was getting in the blind or the tree stand right before work, and then trying to get to work by 8 o'clock, and then I'd have to leave for work at 7:30,
right.
You know, and so I wasn't getting enough time in the stand to even do much.
Well, and that time of year, some of your best hunting's from 9 to 11.
Exactly.
You know, so when did you shoot your deer?
Well, matter of fact, I missed a good one during, like, peak rut. Like, that was the November 10th. I shot right over me, ducked me a little bit.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then they were on lockdown. I didn't even think I was going to kill a good buck after that. They were on hard lockdown for, it seemed like, I don't know, it was a couple weeks for sure. Thanksgiving Day is when I ended up killing that big one, but it was that secondary rut.
Last
for a couple days or whatever.
It was mid-morning though, wasn't it?
Yep, yeah, right at 10:30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's probably just cruising through.
Yeah.
I find, I'm not a whitetail guru by any means, but what I find is November 6th, that seems to be like the day.
When the light turns
because
on.
Because it's right before they lock down. And, I mean, it'll be, if you start hunting, let's say, depending upon the weather, if it's cool, of course, it's going to help with deer movement. But if you start seeing them, then all of a sudden, it's like a light switch turns on. And all of a sudden, you're seeing bucks all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, okay, it's on. Now you got to try and kill one before that lockdown.
Exactly.
Or if you get the lockdown,
then, you know, usually it's a 24-hour period. They're locked down with the doe, and you're hoping to see that buck again before he gets locked down again, you know. And but that's a short window because he might walk 100 yards and find another hot doe, or he might have to go a mile, you know, and hopefully walks right by you. But it's that chess match, so...
It's so funny that you guys are saying this. The first deer, so I don't have any like hunting mentors. I kind of got into it through podcasts and YouTube and following these guys. And the first deer I ever killed, I sat for 60 hours before I ever had a shot at a deer. And I was sitting early October. I was just excited to be out there. In New York, you can hunt like October 1 to January 31st. And on November 4th, 5th, 6th, between 9 a.m. and 11 a.m., you'll kill a deer in New York. I've done two deer, same day, same time, 9:05 a.m. same tree 2 years in a row.
Oh, that's cool. Awesome.
it's interesting how you can pattern them, but this is on public land, so there is a decent amount of pressure. And the one thing that's always in my head is like a Google Maps GPS map, and I'm like, I know where my blue dad is. Like, where is the closest deer? It's somewhere. It's within earshot. It's within rattle earshot of of where I'm at, and just like wanting to be like, I just want to understand what's going on in your brains right now. But it's that puzzle, and I'm not so secretly hoping that eventually Colorado splits a mule deer and a whitetail season, so you could build up points for both, you can hunt both, and I don't know.
You know, there's still a lot. Whitetail's still the redheaded stepbrother.
Yeah.
And so there's still a lot of opportunities where you can get a whitetail-only tag. The problem is you can only get one A-list buck.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it would be good, and I think we'll be headed there. You should be, in my opinion, there's enough of a whitetail population now. You should be able to hunt a mule deer buck and a whitetail buck. You should. But you should be able to. In places like where you guys live, that's perfect because you have some great mule deer hunting, and then you have some great.
And the whitetail are actually taking over the mule deer country, you know. So
you know how that happens. I was talking to a biologist, and early on, I learned this. Whitetail are so much more aggressive than mule deer, even though mule deer tend to be bigger. But they don't necessarily run the mule deer bucks off, but they breed them out. So what will happen is if you have a mule deer buck, a hot mule deer doe, and a whitetail buck, 9 times out of 10, you're going to end up having that mule deer buck run off by that whitetail buck because he's more aggressive. Then he breeds that whitetail doe or that mule deer doe. First generation, it's going to be a cross. But by the second generation,
it's a whitetail.
It's a whitetail. You can never, you will not even be able to tell it has any mule deer blood in it. And so what happens is they end up just breeding the mule deer out.
And I have to show you some pictures of some on my trail cameras. These whitetails, they look like whitetails, but you can tell there's some mule deer in them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're split G2s that are just like mule deer. Like, there's this buck that he looks like he's half whitetail, half mule deer. I've been watching for 3 years. I never can see him in the daytime, but you can tell this whitetail has mule deer in him. There's no doubt.
And I mean, I'd have to talk to biologists about how the actual characteristics, what's the dominant gene, you know, how you have dominant genes that give the whitetail characteristics of the antlers and this and that. And I don't know. I'm not a biologist, but I did stay at Holiday Inn Express one time. So in a situation like that, I have seen where there was a good mule deer population, and over 10 years, you see the whitetails go way up and the mule deer go way down. And talking to biologists, like, they get bred out.
Yep.
They literally breed them out. But there is something about seeing a mule deer rack behind a freaking yucca or a old sagebrush, and you're sneaking in there. You know, there's something about that on the ground type of stuff that I'll never stray away from that. But usually about the time November hits, I've been running and gunning so hard in the mountains, I'm ready for a little me time.
A little tree stand.
Yeah. A little tree stand emotional,
right.
You know.
Connection. That's my favorite part.
The hardest part is walking the, you know, however half mile or whatever it is to get up in the stand, and then you're there. And then you just watch the woods come alive.
It's just so peaceful.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. You listen to, see so much up from up there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my favorite animal to hunt those elk. I've been an elk hunting guide my whole life, basically. But to me, hearing those bugling bulls in the mountains is what gets me going the most out of everything I hunt, you know.
Do you think it's that vocal interaction? It's kind of like goose hunting or even turkey hunting. You know, we always say that turkey or feathered elk, right?
Yeah.
Because you hunt them similar in the way that there's a vocal reaction. And as experienced as you are, you know, what do I need to respond? The bull bugles a certain way. Is that a locate bugle? Is that, you know, and you know what to do. I mean, for me, growing up in New Mexico, I guided mule deer hunters, elk hunters, stuff like that since I was young. I think differently than maybe someone like Jake who's just come out to Colorado and is starting to hunt. I hear a bugle, I know what my response is going to be because of experience.
Yep.
Because I've made the mistakes. You know, a lot of people say, oh, you hear a bark, it's over. Yet I've had a bull bark at me, barked right back at him, and here he comes. You know, so it's what are the responses you need? I think that's part of why that drives. I tend to go with you. If you were to say you can only hunt one species the rest of your life, I'm going to be hard pressed not to hunt elk.
Yep.
Because of the fact that it's that, you know, and you're like, there's something that chills.
Or when you hear, when you know he's coming and you have to set up, you're like, and your heart's pounding. You don't know what he's going to look like coming through those trees. If he's going to be a raghorn or a 340, you right. Don't have, you know.
And everybody says, well, that bugle sounds like, and I'm like, no, because I've heard some of the wimpiest
exactly.
bugles and this huge bull come out, and then I've heard some of the most terrifying growling, and it's a freaking rag five.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I was guiding, this is in southern Colorado, this is probably 10 years ago, and those little Primos snap-on blue reeds, one of the guides would bugle with that thing, and I could tell his bugle
right,
from a mile away.
Mm-hmm. Seven notes.
Boom, 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 yep. boom. Mm-hmm. So we're sitting on this cliff, and I bugled, and I hear him. I said, shit, man. I was like, that's... Well, the other guide must have came over this area. And so we hop back in the truck and we're driving down the road, and that bull's running up the hill, and it was a monster, and I thought it was the other guy. And I was like, I'm never judging a bugle by or a bull by a bugle ever again, you
wow.
know. But it literally sounded like that little Primo's bugle he always does, you know.
It's about this long, and you put the little reed on it, and you put your and you roll your lip through it. I've done the same thing where I was on a ridge and I had another hunter, a younger hunter, and I was working with him. You know, here I am, this experienced guy,
seasoned vet,
and a bugle rings out, and I'm like, now see, that's a guy who's just learning to bugle. I said, you see how he didn't did it, and I'm explaining this bugle, and so then we start walking down, and then we look down, and it's a bull.
Yeah.
What do you? I mean, go figure. Right, it's kind of like I was with the same guy, and we're driving down the road. And there's an antelope, you know how they run next to the truck. And what they're looking to do is they're looking to cross in front of you, right? Well, there's a three barbed wire fence. And I said, we're coming up on it, and he's running like this. And I said, watch, he won't jump this fence, he'll go under. And he goes, no way, he's going too fast. I said, no, antelope will not jump a fence. That sumbuck left and cleared that fence.
I've seen that a few times.
But I've also been on horseback and tried to make a buck or even a doe jump a fence, and they won't do it. They go under, right? Yeah. And right then he turns and looks at me and goes, you don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, but I'm like, I've never seen that. I said, I've been out here. I have hunted antelope my whole life. I've never seen one at a full sprint jump a fence. I've seen them go under a million times.
Yeah, nine times out of ten, they will go under a fence.
I'd even say more than that, probably 49 out of 50.
Yeah.
But I think that's my favorite part about hunting is the unpredictable, you know, you cannot predict animals' behavior. No matter how much you think you can or how much you know about them, they are still very unpredictable.
Right.
And that's the part that makes it the challenge.
Well, it's that challenge we were talking about on another podcast about how you hunt the first day hard. Well, you hunt the last day just as hard as you hunted the first day because... I mean, we all have stories probably of going through a hard hunt and then being successful at the very end. And if you don't come with that same intensity, you don't know. Because you can be as successful the first hour as you can the last hour. Everything has to come together, of course. But that's why we hunt. That's exactly why we hunt.
You know, you have to have a passion for it. Like we... like it's in our blood. We love hunting, you know. Just being in the outdoors, it's just something that is so special to us. Like the first time, like she went on an elk hunt with me. We're at 11,500 feet, and I kill an elk up there. And it's we take pictures quick. It's getting dark, and I quartered that elk up quick. Got the Kafaru pack all loaded up and loaded her up, and she was carrying quarters back down the mountain. I said, "This girl's tough, dude." Yeah. I said, "I'm marrying her."
I knew this one. Yeah,
so, that's funny. That's
so yeah, ever since then, like her and I just been have like we go on the coolest adventures. Matter of fact, we're getting married this summer, and on our honeymoon, we're going on a hunting moon is what she wants to do. So
that's awesome.
We haven't decided where we're going to go, but we're going to do something
cool. That's awesome. How is the communication when you guys are hunting together? I'm going to ask you first, okay? If my wife was with me, there would probably be some things that I said that were really stupid and would be frustrating for her. And the flip side is I would probably find some things she did. You know what I mean? Because when you live together and you love each other, there still can be frustrations. And hunting can be pretty intense.
It's very intense.
So between you guys, I mean, you guys find that the communication is pretty simple. Do you almost slip into almost a different relationship?
Absolutely. We're definitely in a different relationship when we're hunting. Because you have to. I think. Yep. I got to witness him guiding, and so I saw how his interaction with clients.
Okay.
So I was able to see how serious it was. I mean, we would laugh and joke the whole way to where we were hunting, and then a little switch would go off, and then it was just, you know, we're hunting now. I can't say that there haven't been a few times where I've gotten my feelings hurt, or I've been, I thought he was a little too rough and tough, but I truly believe that's why I'm as good as I am today, because I don't want to. It's not that I don't want to upset him. I want to be good for him. I don't want to make dumb mistakes. I want to step up my game. I want to be on the same level. I don't want it to be, he's bringing his little wife along hunting. Right. I want to be hunters.
You don't want to be an anchor. Right. You want to be an asset.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. So, and what about you? How do you feel? I mean, do you feel like you have to be careful with your intensity when you're hunting with her?
Well, I still give her the look sometimes.
Okay.
If she steps on a branch, I'm looking back at her with that look saying, "What are you doing back
right,
there?"
Yeah.
But then if I step on one, I pretend like I didn't.
That's exactly.
Let me ask you this.
Double standard is real.
Let me ask you this. I'm convinced this is true. When you step on a branch, it's not as loud as when they step on the branch.
100% true.
What is the deal with that? Because I was thinking about that the other day. I had some kids with me, and I'm hunting with these kids, and they were loud. And then I started thinking, are they as loud as I think they are, or is it just because of I'm hearing their noise that I'm not in control of, because I'm stepping on sticks too? So yeah. I started thinking, maybe I have a double standard here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a real thing out there for sure.
That's funny.
Yeah, I've had hunters where they're stepping on branches, and I'm like, "Shh, quiet, you're going to spook them all. Don't slam your car door." Or like the wind will blow my car door and slam it, or I'll do something silly, and I just pretend like nothing happened.
Tell me, I've got a story I want to share with you guys. When I was guiding, tell me, I want you to share, what was your most crazy person you guided? Like, tell me a story of, because we all have it. As a guide, you're going to meet some individuals that are interesting. What's one story, a funny story, or maybe something that got a little weird when you were guiding?
Well, one of the funniest things that I've ever seen happen, one guy shot an elk in the woohoo. Whatever you want to call it down there, but that was one
with a bow.
Yep, he was one and done. You know, he had a little bit of blood and he had to go home.
You mean shot him right in the ass, right?
No. Oh, in the hahu.
Oh wow, yep. That's a small target. Should have shot the heart.
He was aiming for the heart, but so that was a funny one. But I had a guy hunting with me a few years back. He killed a 350 class bull with me, and he was he was set on killing something bigger than that. And I was like, dude, a 350 bull's huge. I was like, and we're passing up 330 bulls left and right. I'm calling in. I'm like, we're educating these elk. I was like, 330s are good bulls. You're going to regret it. So he's like, nah, I'm willing to eat tag soup. So it's the last day. I'm glassing up this ridge, and there's a monster, like a 360 class bull, pushing some cows down this little draw. So I said, all right, let's get around them. We get some good wind, and I set him down in the canyon. I get about 200 yards below him. I'm trying to call that whole herd down, and so he can ambush them as they're coming down to this draw to go feed at night. And it's getting dark, and those cows come right by me. Here comes that bull chuckling. I'm like, shoot, he didn't get him. So I hike back up there in the dark, and he's jumping up and down, giving me the thumbs up. He goes, I got that monster. I said, bullshit, dude. I said, he just walked right by me. He goes, nah, he had some big whale tails. I said, well, it must have been a different one. It wasn't that monster we were watching. So long story short, I'm looking for blood. There's no blood. Finally find a couple drops, so we just back out, go in the morning. And I find like guts, like I knew it was a bad shot. I was like, dude, you made a bad shot. So I just had to keep following like hoof prints. And I finally found that bull. I walk up to him, and a mule deer's bit. It looked like a mule deer rack. It was like a 200 inch bull he shot at night, like right before dark, you know? And I was like, see, dude, when you're greedy, that's what happens sometimes. Of course, if you want to kill something big, you got to pass up stuff, but you got to do it to an extent, you know? And you got to know what you're doing. But I literally saw him cry like a little girl. Like, he paid for this hunt, and I was like, dude, be happy you got one. I said, but you still deserve it. I said, you so go ahead and cry. Just to get it over with. Yeah. But
there's got to be expectations, but there also have to be realistic expectations.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to share this story. I don't think I've told you this. So, guiding in New Mexico, I get a phone call from a company I used to guide for, and I had already moved up to Colorado, but they were short a guide. I guess a guy got sick or, you know, what, last minute. Like, it's, hey, can you come down on Thursday? And it's like Tuesday. So I checked my work schedule, you know, kind of what I had on the schedule. I was able to shuffle some things around. It was for a 7-day hunt. So I think it like started on Saturday through Saturday. So I got it. I got the thumbs up from my wife, and off I head down in New Mexico. And I end up, and then you know how it is when you go into camp, you have X amount of guides, and usually the guides are staying here and the hunters are staying here, and the guides usually don't stay in as nice a place as the hunters, which is fine. And so we're staying in a wall tent. They're all staying inside. And then they bring all the hunters start coming in. They into camp. And then you're like, okay, the outfitter's like, okay, Trevin, you're with this guy. Joe, you're with this guy. Fred, you're with this guy. Right, whatever. So I end up getting one of the older guys, which is fine. In this place, there is this, it's public land, but there's some private that they have access to, and there's some ag fields. And it's a rifle hunt, elk rifle hunt, and you are basically, it's not a slam dunk, but it's pretty close to a slam dunk. If these elk are feeding in this field, the way they're going to go back out, you can get up before light and get up to this point, and you're going to have about a 150-yard shot as they work out of the field, because they do it every time. They always kill a bull there first morning if they're there, and they were. So because of the situation, and you know how when a person gets a guide or an outfitter, they have a questionnaire they're supposed to fill out. What condition are you in? How, you know, so we can know how to hunt them. Can they hunt horseback? Can they hunt on the back of a four-wheeler? Can they walk? You know, and of course, according to his thing, he was fine. Retired mailman. So I'm assuming, okay, he walked a lot, right? Maybe he's in decent shape. But we had to walk up this switchback. And it should take you about 40 minutes to get to this spot. So I gave us an hour and 15 minutes. Next morning, get up. Come on, let's go. We go up. We start heading up. And I look back, and he's nowhere to be seen. Oh, like, crud. So I go back. He is got his pants down, and he is relieving himself in the middle of the trail. What? Like, and I'm like, okay, well, maybe maybe the coffee hit him, right?
Yeah.
So now, of course, you're starting to get a little adrenaline or just, you know, starting to get warm. So next time, I got his backpack, I got his jacket, and now I got his rifle, and we're going.
It took us 2 hours. No, 2 hours and 15 minutes to get up to the point. No. I saw the elk go by us. You know, go by. He ended up going to the bathroom 8 times going up there.
Oh, my
gosh.
He
couldn't handle that New Mexico green chili.
No. Turns out he had had a stomach issue that he had surgery on. And so when he had to go, like he had to go then, I guess they'd taken out some of his intestine.
Wow.
So I didn't know that. So we get up there. I don't have the heart to tell him the elk are gone. We get up there. I'm like, I don't know if I can get this guy off of this hill. So we set up there. He goes to sleep. He sleeps till 11 o'clock. In the meantime, I got on the radio and I said, guys, I don't know how I'm going to get him off here. I mean, he's spent just coming up. I mean, this guy is, he's asleep. And so the outfitter's like, okay, well, we're going to get an elk. We got an elk down. We're going to take the four-wheeler over there, get that elk out of there, then we'll come up and get you. Okay. Well, by the time he woke up, he was better. I was able to get him down, walk him down. We took our time. But he was spent. Like, he was done. This is the first morning. So I end up having to hunt him from the truck the rest of the time. Well, I tried the old, let's get him by, I knew some ponds, some dirt, some stock tanks where elk would come and water, but it's hit or miss. It's not like something, it's not like there's plenty of water. I mean, so I'd set him up and we'd sit there throughout the afternoon and the evening and, you know, we end up, I see some elk go into some dark timber, so I work him down kind of casual. I'm like, I don't know if they're going to still be in there or not. And when I'm looking through, and you know that dark timber, you can get low and you can see a lot further than if you stand up because of the branches. So I get down and I can see legs about 80 yards further up in the dark timber. And I go, I whisper to him, okay, there's an elk right up here. He goes, huh?
Oh,
and then it's just elk, right? So I'm feeling like I'm the worst guy in the world. So then we're taking him, and we're going through in the truck, and I got a buddy who he'd already killed out. He was one of the other guys. I said, dude, come help me try and find some elk for this guy. I want to get him a shot so bad. We get him on some cows. He won't shoot a cow. It's fine. That's his deal. We go, and we end up getting in the truck, and he says, stop. And I'm like, uh-oh. Well, he gets out. He doesn't quite make it to get his to get his chonies down.
Oh, no.
Okay, we are back a ways. Now, my buddy, the other guy that was helping me, is sitting in the middle of the truck. This is a single cab pickup. Oh. He's on the outside. I said, you want to go back to camp and get a change of drawers? No, I'm okay. That guy in the middle, he about puked. Oh. I mean, so the rest of the day, we're driving around looking for elk, and no. I got my window rolled down. I'm hanging out the window, right? That poor guy. Anyway, 7 days goes by. He could have killed a cow. He didn't want to. And he came to me afterwards, tipped me. He said, you know what? You were the most hardworking, understanding guy. He said, this is my 5th elk hunt. He said, this is the first time I've seen elk.
Really?
Wow. It's so interesting.
He said, thank you so much.
Well, you have to have patience with your hunters. That's one thing. Even like your family, whoever you're with, like if you want to be successful, it takes patience, you know?
Well, hunting is patience, basically.
And for him, of course, my heartstring, I mean, I was glad that I stuck it out and kept it. I titled that story The Phantom Crapper because of the fact, in a joking way, because, I mean, what a unique, I mean, first of all, if he would have been more honest in the way he filled out the form, I would have hunted him very different.
So you didn't take that same trail back, though, did you? That you went up on?
Yeah. No, we never.
It stops along the way.
No. I'm pretty sure that was done.
That closed the trail.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway.
Not even the elk would go up there.
When you're a guide, you see a wide variety. I mean, I've taken guys that promised me they were in the best shape of their life,
and you know, a half a day hunting the way we're used to hunting, and they're done. Or I've taken a guy who I'm like, oh man, this guy, I'm gonna have to take it easy, and they never stop. And you're like, dude, you're amazing in the mountains. And he's like, I'm just stubborn. And he's sweating pickle juice. You know, I mean, they're just drenched, but he just never would quit. Killed an elk because he had that mental fortitude, and because I knew I could get him on elk if he could handle the country.
Right.
And so it's hunting is such a unique thing. And then you take bow hunting, which is even more, because the patience, as you said, Jessica, has to come into effect. Because where in a rifle you have that 200, 300, 400 yard barrier, it's 20, 30, 40 yard now with a bow. So, you know, very different, very different.
I think with hunting, especially bow hunting, it's being delusional doesn't take you very far.
No, it doesn't.
Like, I used to do stand-up comedy in New York City. You have to be delusional to think that what you have to say is funny and worthwhile of other people's attention. And about 90 to 95% of those people are insane and it doesn't work out. And then 5% turn into Bill Burr and Joe Rogan and whoever else is out there. But with hunting, it's amazing that this guy was on 5 guided hunts. You got to presume thousands of dollars spent. And it's just like, be honest with me. Be honest with yourself. This will be better for both of us.
Right.
And I think you pointed out some of your shortcomings when you started, but then the mental fortitude kicked in. Mm-hmm. You put in the time. You put in the practice. When you drew on that big buck, you weren't concerned with how big that buck was. You were concerned with the spot, putting your pin on that spot, making the shot. Mm-hmm. That's bow hunting.
Yes, it is. And there's going to be highs and lows. Like I told her, I shoot my bow every single day. I feel like I'm a good hunter, but sometimes you make a bad shot or an animal moves, and it's uncontrollable. So, I mean, you can't beat yourself up if something does happen. You just got to strive to even be better, I tell her, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And hearing you say that, shoot your bow every day, and Cameron Haynes is always posting it, oh, I shoot every day. Here's a 200-yard balloon pop or whatever the thing is. I live in an apartment in Denver, and I shoot every day about 6 yards, 5 yards it's down the hallway of my apartment.
Yep. Yep.
Your technique is your technique. Right. Your nose hits the same part of the string every time. Yep. Today I was down at Cheyenne Mountain, 80 yards, first shot, hit it. And I was like, I didn't expect that, but your shot sequence is your shot
muscle
sequence.
Muscle memory.
That's exactly it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then you have a consistent anchor, you know, like a guy that shoots his bow like right before season, he's not going to be like a guy that's been shooting his bow for months, you know.
Well, and that's where you get into stuff like Phil Mendoza's alpha bow hunting competitions. You know, I do that, number one, because I love the camaraderie, and all my buddies, all my bow hunting buddies are there. But number two, I get to test myself against guys like James Hardesty, who, if you look at James and you look at me and you say, who could run faster? I bet 90% would probably put their money on me. But then you turn around and you look at that guy who is, he's got to be 250, 250 pounds, big guy, stout guy, has a lung capacity like nobody I've ever done, because he does that
apnea, spearfishing,
and he can hold his breath forever, and his shot sequence is so on, he literally makes me look like an idiot. Now, we go out on 3D course, I can shoot pretty good, but I don't have a shot sequence that's under a time pressure, but when you're hunting, it is. Because that animal's only going to stand there for so long. So you put yourself in these positions to make yourself better.
Yeah.
Not only is it a bunch of fun, but you're seeing where your shortcomings are. And I'll come back after I go to one of Phil's shoots, and I might not just be shooting like a normal practice round. I know what I need to focus on. I need to focus on this. I need to get my heart rate up, and then I need to be able to still get that accurate shot off in a quicker pace. Because the fact of the matter is, if you're hunting in an elk scenario, most likely you had to get to where you're going to take that shot from, and it wasn't flat ground.
Exactly.
So you're going to have a little bit of a breath. You're going to be out of breath, and you still have to execute.
Yeah.
And so,
well, it's one thing that Jess said earlier also is shooting out of a tree stand is different than shooting out of a blind. And
you've also got like the weather factor, like whitetail season is cold. You've got extra layers on. You're not moving like you are,
absolutely,
you know, with a t-shirt on and, you know, when you're practicing. It's,
and I think those things can actually make it fun. Sometimes I'll go to a 3D range like up at Bar Lake near Denver, and it just gets a little boring. You're just shooting at a bullseye all the time. But then they have the 10 target 3D course, and I'll take three arrows and I'll do one from 2 feet, one from one knee, one from two knees. And even that elevation change of 2 or 3 feet, the way I'm looking through my peep, the way my forward sight is in that sight window, it's just different. And to make as many things as possible second nature in bow hunting is what's going to help you get success when that opportunity comes.
And not just second nature as much as understanding your limits.
Right.
I can honestly say I'm pretty accurate to 60 yards. Give me a 15 mile per hour crosswind, and that goes down to 45 yards. Why? Right. Because of a factor. Just because of a factor outside of my control. Now, put me on uneven ground on my knees. Now you've just expanded that. So the only way you're going to know that is if you put yourself in those positions and you say, okay, in this situation, my effective range is not 60 yards.
That's just like a lot of guys never set up their third axis on their bows. They're out, they go up in the woods, they're shooting downhill at a bull, and they're like, shoot, I missed him by a foot or 2 feet, you know? And you got to be prepared when you're going hunting. Right. Simple as that. You got to do your homework. What if it's regarding scouting, but you got to make sure your equipment's dialed in before you're even out there.
The good thing about that, though, is it's a lot of fun to get to that position.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, we love
it. There's something pretty zen about the flight of an arrow. I'm not trying to knock on Ted Nugent or anything like that, but there is something pretty zen about being able to hit your anchor point, being able to see that pin settle, your release breaks, arrow goes through, and you're watching that arrow, and it hits the dadgum mark.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's like shooting a three-pointer. You feel it at the tip of your finger.
Exactly.
Yep, you know, good. It's money.
You got
right
the follow through. Everything's
It's that's a pretty, you know, you talk to the best archers in the world, whether it's, you know, a Levi Morgan or a Gillingham, or, you know, even Aaron Snyder talks about this, you know, with his trad bow now, because he's really, really become an authority on traditional bow hunting, because he's just poured himself into it. But the ability to release, and you know where your arrow's going to hit. It's that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think that's the difference. Not that I'm some great archer, but the guys who pull out their equipment, blow off the dust 3 weeks before the season starts, are the guys who want to tell everybody they're a bow hunter. Versus the guy who's shooting in his living room or going out on, you know, it's freezing cold or it's raining. Right. It's because you can't not go, because you want to go.
Right.
And I think that's the thing that I really like about the CBA and this community is you just bump into people that are that stoked, that excited about it. And it's cool.
It's cool to
like,
connect, the people that feel the same.
And have you guys on here, and like we just met 2 minutes ago, but just to be able to share these stories and the same passion, like we got this dinner coming up in an hour or so, and I'm just so excited to see these like Big Eight awards and to hear the guys speak, and man, it's I'm just excited to be a part of this community.
Before we go, I want to ask you guys, how do we effectively encourage or promote bow hunters to be a member of the CBA? I'm not talking about recruiting new bow hunters. I'm talking, we have a lot of bow hunters in Colorado. How can we reach out to that fellowship that is a brotherhood anyway, a sisterhood, if you know, how do we get them, you know, with the magazine now, we're doing all of these new designs and we're reaching out and trying to be more cutting edge with social media, all this stuff. How do we effectively reach so that we can gather those and grow our membership as the CBA? What are your thoughts on that?
I think more kids need to get involved, you know, and get those kids pushed up into this. I mean, a lot of guys are older guys that are coming here, and like they don't have any kids following their footsteps. That's going to be gone, you know.
Right.
So the younger generation is who we got to focus on getting in.
The problem is, though, we need mentors for those kids.
And I, you know, I would, like, I try to be a good role model for all my nephews and right. stuff, get mm-hmm. them into bow hunting, because it's a special, it's a special gift that we're lucky to do, you know. People don't realize, just have, shooting a bow is amazing. Like,
it really is.
It's like one of the most amazing things you can do. Right. There's yeah. nothing, you yeah. can't explain it. You guys know. Yeah. It's just, it's just amazing. But I think that reaching out to the kids is probably going to be the main thing.
Well, so as I sit here and I think through this, because I do spend a lot of time thinking about this, we're missing, it's, let me use this. If you have a whitetail property and you're managing it and you shoot all the two-year-old bucks, what happens to your age class?
It's gone.
You're missing an age class, right? Yep. You have older bucks that get old, and then either die of natural causes, or maybe you take one. And then you have these younger bucks that are the next year 2 years old, right? Well, it seems like in this, we have an older population, and then we have a younger population, but we're missing... like 30 you, and 40 Jake, olds.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you came in, you know, you're that mid age, mid range. We need that because you are the guys that really, and me too, and you are going to mentor the kids, which is going to be the next generation. But right now, it's like we're missing an age class. Mm-hmm. Where, how do we get the current 25 to 30 to 45 year olds?
I think social media, just I think that's where it is. That's yeah. where they're. That's where their connections are. That's yeah. where they look yeah. for everything.
I mean, all these teens, all they're doing is playing on their phones. I mean,
and if you can reach them through social media and then get them to events like this where they're in person, and then, you know, once they make, create relationships with each other, and then they'll, you know, I think that's yeah. a good way to start.
I was at the range today, and there was a guy who was at the end of the range, and he was listening to the Joe Rogan podcast. It was probably John Dudley or somebody else on there, and he's shooting his bow, and I struck up a conversation with him. He's like, I just kind of got into this, and I'm like, that is exactly how it happens. You want to do this, you kind of chose it on your own, and I think we're doing a good job of it, but you're right. Encourage people to come out and get from online life to reality
right.
and see how fun it is.
Right. Because you can't be a bow hunter online.
You know, you can.
Techno.
You can be a because right now the other negative, the good thing about social media we just talked about, but the other negative about social media is you can be anybody you want to be.
Yeah, that's true.
You
yeah.
can put up false a false image.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. But the resources, and we talked about this on another podcast about how abundant the resources are for somebody like Jake, who was searching, how do I get plugged in? That's how he found out about the CBA. He was listening to Kafaru.
Yeah, Henry was on.
Yeah, when Henry was on. And then all of a sudden, Jake comes to a meeting, and boom, there's a whole new world, mm-hmm. A culture that he is now part of and has a new, surrounded by guys that are more experienced. But I think that's the key. We got to keep at it. And for those of you listening, you might know somebody who's a hardcore bow hunter, but they're not a member of the CBA. And my question, I say this all the time, why? Why not? Why not become a member? Because this is the next generation. The Colorado Bow Hunters Association is what's going to protect this for the next generation.
Yeah, for less than a pack of broadheads, yeah. be a member.
$30. So anyway, enough sales stuff about that.
And these new magazines are awesome.
They really are.
Well, we're it's trying. Exciting. We're yeah. trying. Yeah, and we need to. We have sat and had podcasts with a couple of guys nobody would have known about because they don't do social media. Mm-hmm. Yet they are amazing bow hunters. Like, one's working on his third Colorado Big Nine.
Oh yeah. Wow!
Third.
I yes. can't get my first one.
I know. I'm exactly. So, you know, we have this legacy here in Colorado. So we're going to try and connect.
Yeah, we'll
and hopefully we can be that connector.
Yeah, connect that's awesome. The dots. Yeah.
Before we go, do you have anything you guys want to plug? Your business, your social, your
well,
the
we
CBA?
Just wanted to say thanks for having us
yeah,
on here.
Yeah, this is exciting. Thank you, guys.
You guys are really neat guys. The CBA is such an awesome event. We're fortunate to be here, and thanks for sharing our story on our pronghorn. And
I can't wait to you to write me an article so I can share it with everybody because you took great pictures.
Yeah, we'll start working on it. Well, actually, I started writing a little bit on it. I'll get it emailed over to you, and we'll get it some together.
Yeah. That's awesome. Sure. With everybody. Jess, Steve, thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
And Jess, I just want to thank you for being willing to sit down and share, be vulnerable, because you are a success story, and there's so many other women that can do the exact same thing. Absolutely. They might not have a Steve to follow around, but
just one Steve.
There's only one Steve. But the one thing you can say is that there are people that, if I don't care if you are a female, if you are younger, if you are older, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. If you put your mind to it and you practice, you know, there's people that will help.
Absolutely.
So
this is great.
I can't wait to hear about your whitetail you're going to kill this year.
All right. Yeah, I can't wait to tell you the story. It's going to be awesome. Yeah.
Well, thanks for listening, guys. And we are going to go. And we got the CBA, as you probably have heard, them getting set up in the background for the banquet. We've got that coming up. I'm hoping we might be able to even sneak in a few more podcasts before dinner.
Let's try it, man. Everybody out there, become a CBA member. If you are already, thank you. And stay tuned.